food makes people happy and drinks make people happy, and giving a person an experience. That's the most important thing for me in hospitality, giving each individual that comes and sits in front of me or comes and sits at our restaurant or comes and sits at any bar I work at, is giving them an experience.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. For many over the last 2 years, COVID has thrown a huge curveball. Amongst this upheaval, some have experienced life's curveballs in exponential ways too. Not just the challenge of the pandemic, but challenges and uncertainty that can roll in with a new tide at any given moment. Alan Nikolovsky is from family-owned Antico Woodfire Pizza in Narellan, New South Wales. Alan, how are you?
Good, man. How you doing?
Good. You're got a part of a family pizzeria. Well, what's it like being involved in a family operation like that?
So my background's always been bars. So I kind of came from like running and operating bars, and I ended up becoming like a GM. So coming into the family thing, you're like always a part of everything. Like, so no matter what happens outside of work with the family, inside of work, everything, it can get a little bit much, but at the same time, it's so, so rewarding because I get to work next to my brother, my sister, my mum and dad, and we get to like experience this amazing thing and achieve all these great things together. It's actually really fun. Can be hard at times, as I said.
Well, the last couple of years have been pretty challenging, and everyone moved to takeaway models. Being a pizza offering, what's it been like in a family operation with a product that is traditionally one that people think of takeaway?
Well, we are actually extremely, extremely fortunate. So we've been around for about 15 years now in the area, in Narellan, in the Camden area. So we've got quite a bit of a following. So when it came to like lockdown for us, it meant that for the first period there, like last year when COVID first hit, we were all living at home with mum and dad because it was such on short times, as you know. We're all living together, working together every day. And then we kind of like, me and my brother spoke to each other at the beginning. We were like, cool, man, well, we might have to work 7 days a week during this thing just to see it out, because we weren't sure what was going to happen. And I'm sure everyone else felt the same way. And for the first, I think it was about 6 weeks or so, we worked 7 days. We were just like, cool, hustling, getting it done. And then we realized, hold on a second, people really like pizza, no matter what's going on around the world, no matter what's happening. People will always really like pizza. Like, you can be sad, you can be happy, you can not have money, you'll scrape together something to get pizza. People love it. So we were quite fortunate with that. And because we all work together and we all work so hard, and we try our best to give the best product that we can. And we're so fortunate, we've got such a nice following from people around us that we actually survived okay. It was definitely strange, don't get me wrong. Like, standing around, you're not playing like restaurant music, you're just playing like this heavy techno just to try to get through the shift, and you're cooking 400 or 500 pizzas. You're like, all right, cool, well, I don't need to listen to this like super nice and chill music. Let's just play some real loud stuff, get it done, hustle, and just make it happen. And that's what we did. It was 6 very tough weeks. But then we all kind of sat down with a smile on our face and like, oh man, we'll be fine. We'll be cool. Just keep doing what we're doing. Just keep hustling and get it done. We were, as I said, there was a lot of businesses, unfortunately, and I saw so many of my friends having to close down businesses and do all these things due to this. But we were extremely fortunate, and something that we're still, every single time we do anything, we try and thank the community around us, and we try and push and we try and give back to the community. We're so thankful for that. We were fine. It was hard work for 6 to 8 weeks, but we were fine.
I want to explore your family history shortly, but you mentioned the bars. You've been integral in some of the really influential bars in Sydney over the years. What led to the interest in working in bars?
So the reason I got into bars, I was at uni at the time and I was studying PE teaching, and I was like, all right, cool, I'll go to uni and I'll get a side job. And I was lucky that I was going to the gym with one of my friends who was running World Bar at the time. I don't know if you know or remember World Bar, like back in King's Cross. Yeah, so he was like, man, just give me a resume and I'll give you a job, you can pick up teapots and help out. I was like, yeah, cool, sounds great. Funny enough, that's the only resume I ever handed in my whole life, which is quite nice. Yeah. So I gave him a resume. He gave me a call back. He's like, come this weekend. I was like, yeah, cool. I went in. I was picking up teapots, and I was like, holy shit, man, this is the coolest job in the whole wide world. Like, I'm picking up teapots and picking up glasses, or like, but there's music, it's cool as, and there's all these people I know. And I was like, this is rad. And all my mates were like, oh, you're working at Wellbar. That's so cool. That's mad. That's really cool. And I was doing that, and I was at uni, and I was like, I think the reason why I went to uni was kind of just like, all right, cool, just following that trend, you know what I mean? You finish school, you go to uni, you do this, you do that. It's just kind of like that public, like that trend that everyone does. And I was like, man, I don't like uni. It's not for me. I hated it. I was going there, and I was like, oh, this sucks. Just trying to, like, I didn't even go to any lectures. And I was like, this isn't for me. This isn't fun. But at the same time, I was working in, like, one of the coolest nightclubs at the time in Sydney, and I was like, shit, this is fun. And then I was like, oh, well, I'm just going to leave uni. And I left uni, and I just went and pursued this career in, like, bartending. And I started working in this nightclub and picking up, like, teapots and everything, and, like, eventually got pushed up to the bar and started doing these things. And I remember, like, it was, like, a year or so of doing it, and I was, like, I had this, like, I think, how old was I? This is, like, 13. I was 20. I had this existential crisis. I was like, oh, man, I can't keep doing this. I need to actually get my life on track. I was like, I'm going to go back. I'm going to move back to the area. I'm going to go work at an RSL. I'm going to go back to uni. I'm going to finish my teaching degree. So I moved back home to my parents' place, which is in Holsworthy, and I got a job at Moorbank RSL. I lasted two months. I was like, what the hell am I doing? I was like, I don't like uni. I don't like doing anything. Like, I really enjoy working in bars. And like, I was quite fortunate that I made really good mates with a lot of people during the World Bar days. That one of my other mates was running a bar called Flinders. I don't know if you remember the Flinders back in the day. It was all the Bang Gang guys owned it. Andy Penny was the GM, who's like one of my still really good mates, and had all these other dudes. And my mate was like, hey, why don't you just come and help us out and just like bartend for a little bit? I was like, yeah, sounds great. Went over there and then got taught how to like make cocktails. And I was like, holy shit, man, this is really good. I really, really like this. I was like, well, I don't really like uni. So I left uni for the second time. And I was like, I'm just going to stick this out, move back to the city, move to Paddington, and just like started like working at Flinders, eventually became a manager there. And then from there, I got poached to help the boys at Tio's open up Tio's. And then I was there for the beginning. Like, I helped like that's in my opinion, in my hospitality career, probably my most favorite moment of my hospitality career is being part of the opening for that. Like, we sanded everything together. Like, we built the whole bar together. Like, we put all the tiles in. We painted everything together. Like, we did everything. Like, from the morning we got in there, did everything together. When I got lunch, ate dinner together, and the same thing the next day. And it was just like, it's just such a memorable part of my hospitality career, which is like, in my opinion, Tio's is still probably top two bars in Sydney, if not Australia.
Well, when Tio's landed, it made a huge impact on the city. Do you have any stories from those times that you can share?
Oh man, I've got about 5 hours worth of stories if you want to dig deep. But funnily enough, it was actually their 10th birthday yesterday, and I went in and had a couple of drinks with Jeremy, who's one of the owners, who's one of my dearest friends, and we were just talking about some of the stuff that we did and how we did everything. And There was so many funny and dumb stories. Like, one of the funniest ones was, we thought it was a great idea to get axolotls on the bar. And so we, do you know what an axolotl is? Like a weird pet that turns, like, if you put it on ground, it turns into like a weird lizard thing. And if you keep it in the water, it doesn't. And we're just like, we had these two pets and a fish tank behind a bar. A bar that's been run by 22-year-olds and, like, quite fortunately, it was probably the most popular bar at the time. Like, we used to have a queue down the road, man, before 4 o'clock, before we went open. Like, it was packed. And then we just – and we were like, oh, yeah, cool, let's get axolotls. That's a genius idea. Worst idea we've ever had. We had these two pairs, and we're like, man, we got to give these up. We ended up giving them away to, like, another family, like, a friend of ours that ended up looking after them. Well, that's just one of the – dumb stories that we did. Like, we used to, me and Jeremy, when we finished work, we used to try and have a competition who could stack more chairs on top of their head, like bar stools. What else do we do? Man, there's so many. I could go on for hours. As I said, like, it's such a wild, busy time, but it's the most memorable time of my life. Like, me and Russell, who was one of the other guys that opened it with us, for the first 7 weeks, I think we worked every day. I think it was like 7 weeks, maybe six. And I remember, like, we got our first day off together and we're like, all right, cool, man. Let's just go to a bar together. So we went to Shady Pine. Instead of doing what normal people would do, which is go and relax and chill out, we went to a bar together and had heaps of drinks instead of relaxing. But, man, like, as I said, like, that is such a memorable part, and those guys are such good friends of mine now, and I'm so proud of everything they're doing. Like, they just, I don't know if you noticed, released the Seltzer OK. They just got number 23 in the world for Cantina OK. Like, it's wild. Yeah, it's wild. They're such good dudes too, and everything they're doing is amazing.
You briefly mentioned Shady Pines, which became a big part of your life for a period of time. Tell us about that.
4 years. 4 years. So I, after Tio's, I went to Baxter. So I was at Baxter for 2 years. At the time I was at Baxter Inn, we were number six in the world. We got number one bar team in Australasia 2 years running. I wasn't a part of not a main part of that whole team, but like by that point we pretty much won every single award you could in Australia. Like if you walked into the staff room, it was just, we had to build extra shelves for like all the awards. There's just awards everywhere. So when I was at Tio's, I was an okay bartender, but I was there for fun. I was there to have a good time. That's what it was about. I was 24, whatever. When I went to Baxter, it was like, it was such a, like, I wouldn't call it a rude awakening because I don't like to use that word, but it was like, it was a thing where I was like, hold on, I just got thrown in this pool of some of the best bartenders in Australia and some of the best managers in Australia. And here I am trying to make my, you know, become who I am. So I got, like, everything I knew became so much more refined. I went from being an okay bartender to actually quite a good one. Like, my service was okay, it was fun, became really refined and did everything. And I was just like, oh man, holy shit, there's a whole other world of bartending. Before it was, for me, prior to Baxter, bartending was just something you did just to have fun. But when I went to Baxter, I was like, oh man, it kind of like, and it's something that I don't think a lot of people realize. It's something that I was like, people think hospitality is just like a gateway job, you know what I mean? They're like, oh yeah, cool, it's just a job I do while I'm at uni, or it's a job I do, but people don't realize that it's actually, it's a career. Like, it's one of the best careers you could ever have. It allows you to meet people and do these things and become this, like, I don't know, like the best version of yourself, because you learn so much about yourself and you become louder and you have fun and you're funnier and you're doing all these things. And that's what Baxter was for me. It just made me realize that I was like, all right, cool. So I actually really like what I'm doing, and now I'm going to pursue this seriously. So it was there that I got the wake-up call, and I was there for 2 years. And then after, yeah, it was 2 years, and I remember I got the phone call from Jason and Anton. It's one of those questions that you don't need to think about. When someone asks you, like, yeah, straight away. I was like, yep, done. I was like, oh, and then I thought about it, I walked away, I was like, oh, hold on, I should have asked a few more questions, but I didn't. It was just like, they're like, do you want to be the next GM of Shady? He's like, yep, done, I'm there, I'm ready, when do I start?
Tell us about Shady Pines and what was so special about it for you.
Oh man, as you know, it's the coolest bar, in my opinion, in the world. It's easily the best bar in the world. What Anton and Jason did at the beginning, and then what Jeremy and Alex went in there, and every other staff member like Muffin and Bobby and everyone that went in there and had their own touch to it, created the most beautiful bar in the world. I still go there. I ran that bar for 4 years. I still go there to this day, sit at the end of the bar, and I'm still in awe of it. Like, I look around and I'm like, man, this is just cool. You walk down those stairs and you get lost. You're in a different world straight away. You forget where you are.
What is it that makes a great bartender?
Being nice. That's what makes a great bartender. It's not about, you can teach anyone how to make a cocktail. I can teach a monkey how to make a cocktail in 10 minutes probably. I'm not disregarding from bartending. I'm not saying bartenders are not good, but you can't teach people personality. You can't teach people how to be nice to people. There was some, I don't know if you know a guy called Marco Farioni who used to own the Island Bar and a couple of other places. And he said one thing that I will never forget. You have 30 seconds from the time that a person walks into your bar to grab their attention. After that, you lose that person. So I don't care what you're doing. I don't care what you are. You just, you get their attention, you say hi, you do everything. That's what makes a great bartender. A person that greets someone and a person that makes someone feel like they're sitting in their lounge room. You're not sitting in a bar. If I have a person in front of me, I want them to feel like I'm there at my house on the couch and we're having a drink. My friend Jess Arnott, who's from Perth, said one thing. She's like, I don't care what you order, man. If you order a vodka soda, I'll make you the best goddamn vodka soda in this whole wide world. I'm not going to judge you on what you order. I'm going to make sure you have the best time. Some of these people were like, and you got to remember, some of these people that come out to the city live in the suburbs. So some of these people will be saving for 6 months and some to 12 months because they've got kids or whatever to come out and have one night in the city. And if you're a dick about it, if you're like, you order a vodka soda, nah, you don't have to have that, like, whatever. You're a prick. You just ruined this person's night. That could potentially be their only one night of the year. Like, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you do. I don't care what you order. You make sure that every person that sits in front of you has the best night of their goddamn life, and that's what makes a great bartender. I don't care if you can make a nuclear daiquiri six ways, upside down, sideways. If you don't make a person in front of you feel comfortable and happy, you're not doing a good job. You're not a good bartender. There's no ego in bartending. People need to forget ego is non-existent. It's not a part of bartending.
You mentioned the family restaurant that's been around for 14 years, but take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play in your family?
Huge, huge, huge role. So my dad opened up his first restaurant when I was 5 years old. I'll tell you about my life. I grew up in Macedonia. We left Macedonia when I was 10, moved to New Zealand, lived there till I was 13. Also learned how to speak English when I was in New Zealand prior to that. Like, I knew the basics, but prior to that, we had no idea. We lived in New Zealand till I was 13, then moved here when I was 13, which is 20 years ago. But my dad opened up his first pizza restaurant when I was 5 years old, called Allen & Co. It was in our neighborhood. It was in our neighborhood where I grew up in Macedonia. And he did that with my uncle, who's his brother. And he did quite well from it. And then they ended up opening up another spot in a town in Macedonia, which is where I'm from. So I'm from Skopje, which is the capital. But Ohrid is another part of the Macedonia, which is kind of like the touristy part. And opened up another small, tiny, tiny restaurant in a part, like, they called the Old Town, which is like, it was right next to a church. Ended up becoming so popular, they used to have to borrow seats from the restaurant next door and try and fit people in. And you're like, all right, cool. We're just like, wherever you can grab a seat, just sit down. And from there, he ended up getting a spot right in, what we call, I don't know what you'd call it here. Like, you know how Pitt Street Mall, we call it Çarşıya, which is like where people hang out and walk through and there's all the cafes. He ended up opening up a spot there, which ended up becoming one of the most popular spots in Macedonia. And I was quite fortunate. I grew up in those places. So, like, I still have memories when I was 8 years old. I'd be in bars playing pool with all the waiters and waitresses till, like, 2 a.m., like, just hanging out and playing pool and, like, growing up in this restaurant, making pizzas when I was, like, 7, 8 years old. So I guess you could say that I always grew up in hospitality. I was always around it. So then after that, we left there and then we moved to New Zealand and Dad did all these other things. He went and worked for Wendy's at the time. And then when we moved to Australia, he opened up the first Krispy Kreme.
Wow.
In Liverpool. Yeah. Which is something that he's still very proud of. And I'm sure he'll tell you about it if you ever speak to him. So he opened up the first Krispy Kreme here. And then from there, he was kind of like, it was always in the back of his head. My dad's one of those people that no matter what he's doing, he's always thinking 5 years ahead, no matter how old he is. So it was always in the back of his head. He was like, man, I'm going to do another restaurant here. And then we opened up the one out west, as I said, 15 years ago and did that. And then, like, we all built it together. Like, my brother was like, how old was my brother then? 12. I just finished high school. My sister was like 8 and we all put the tiles in and we did everything together and did it all. And then I went and, as I said to you prior, like, tried to do my career in uni and all these other things, which didn't really work out. And then I did all the bar stuff, but I was always kind of helping out whenever I could back at the restaurant. And then after running Shady's, I was like, all right, cool. Well, I'm kind of done in Sydney. Like, I've achieved everything I wanted to achieve and more. Like, I got nominated for everything I wanted to get nominated for. Like, I had the best staff, and some of my staff members now, like, some of the best bartenders in the world. Like, Evan Strove worked with me, and he's now best bartender in Australia. Louis, who moved to London, is now the head bartender at Lioness. Iggy is running, like, helping run Alberto's. There's, like, there was so many of my bartenders. Like, Jasmine, who was one of my favorites, went and she's now working at Cantina. Like, I had all this amazing staff, and I did everything, and I was like, I don't really want to do anything else. I'm kind of, like, done here. And then at that time, Jason, who was still part of Swill House, had a bar called Dulcie's down in Marimbula. I don't know if you know where Marimbula is, down south.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, man, sounds like you need a break. Why don't you go down south and just hang out? You can live in my house. And I lived in a sweet mansion called The Grange, which was built in, like, 1840s. It was, like, a proper mansion with, like, haunted, and it was wild. And I helped run the bar down there. And I had a blast. It was just like a great 9 months. And while I was down there with my really good mate Ride, we were sitting at the RSL one day, and we both love, like, natural wine and wine tastings. And we're sitting at the RSL having Coronas. Don't ask me why. And we were like, oh, man, we need to put on a wine tasting down here. I reckon people would come down and it could be cool. It could be a lot of fun for people. And then from then on, and he said to me, he goes, I've got this great name. It was a great name for a wine tasting, which actually I found out later it wasn't his. It's another mate of ours called Joel, who does Benson and the Mooch wines, which are delicious. But it's called Natty by Nature. And we're like, oh, yeah, like that band, Naughty by Nature. It's cool. So then we're like, for the next 3 months, we worked on this wine tasting, which ended up turning into like a small 400-person festival that we had, like, all these cool winemakers and amazing bands. And, like, we had, like, I think it was, like, 85% of people were from out of Marimbula. Like, it was, like, people from Melbourne, people from Canberra, people from Sydney all flew down just for this tiny thing that me and my friend Ryan decided to come up with while we're having Coronas at Marimbula RSL. And it was great. And then after that, people were like, oh, we want you to do, like, Natty by Nature here. We want you to do it here. We want you to do it here. And we did a few things, and we're like, no, let's just – we did it all, and then we're like, no, we're too busy doing our own thing. Let's put it on ice. But then we'll come back and we'll do something. But we decided we'll only do anything in Marimbula. The only place we'll do Natty by Nature will always be in Marimbula. So we've kind of been chatting about it recently. We're probably going to do one next year in October, again, down south, but try and focus more on the music and the wine, less on the food. So that's another chapter. That's just something else that we're working on.
You mentioned your Macedonian background and that you grew up there. Tell us a bit about the cuisine. Is there any dishes or feasts that you can share that sort of exemplify your experiences?
Well, I know one of your favorite questions is talk about family and food, and something that it's in Macedonia is so family oriented and so food oriented. Like I'll give you a perfect example. Like, someone will invite you for a coffee at their house. You know, like, here you go for a coffee and you're like, all right, cool, we'll have a coffee. There, nah, man. It's like it's a whole different thing. It's a 4-course meal plus coffee. The whole house gets cleaned. So, like, you go to someone's house for a coffee, there's salads, there's all these homemade pastries, there's sarma, which is, in I guess the easiest way for people to know, it's the cabbage leaves wrapped with meat and rice, and there's everything. So, like, for me growing up over there, everything was food. Food for me, when people go, oh, what's food mean to you? People are like, oh, yeah, I just eat. That's not what that means to me. Food for me is family. Food for me is getting together. It's this whole experience. Like, when we sit down and have lunch, we sit down at 3 and we won't finish till 6, because you sit down and you have your entree, you have, like, little soup, and then you snack on things, and you go again, you have rakia, which is like a drink that we make over there from grapes that you grow, and then you have, like, different parts of the pork. So another thing about Macedonia, because it's not a very rich country, is they will get a whole pork. The whole family will save for the whole year and buy a whole pork, but then they'll look after and they'll help it grow. But then when they use it, they actually use every single part of it. So there's no waste. So that whole, like, you know how people here got obsessed with farm to table a few years ago? Well, that's what I grew up with. Everything over there is farm to table. It's what you grow up because people don't have money. So it's like, all right, cool. Well, we're going to grow our own veggies in our backyard. We're going to buy this pig and we're going to use every single part of it. So everyone's a butcher. Everyone's a farmer and everyone's eating and making this most amazing food. Someone like my grandma's one of the best chefs I've ever had food with. So the cuisine, like when you say the cuisine there, it's just like, it's a lot, because it's a cold country. So it's a lot of like heavy stews and heavy meats, a lot of like, it's a very Turkish kind of like influence, but also that like Balkan kind of influence, like a lot of like still like veggies with stews and whole animals and stuff. It's great food. Don't get me wrong. When I go there, I put on, if I'm there for 2 weeks, I'll put on 5 kilos. It's amazing. It's like, as I said, man, like there, like eating there is a different thing. Like when I go back there, like I eat a kilo of tomatoes in a meal because the tomatoes taste like tomatoes. They're grown in my grandma's backyard, everything. I'm like, holy shit, man, this tastes so good. And it's like eating there is like something I look forward to. Here, I'm just like, oh, cool, I'm hungry, I'll just eat. When I'm hungry there, I'm like, oh, man, I know this is going to be amazing because I know I'm going to sit down with like 5-6 people and it's going to be like, it's going to be a 2-hour meal and I get excited for it. And the thing is, I go back there and get excited, but everyone over there is doing that every single day. So for them, it's just like, oh, why are you so excited? Why are you so happy to do this? It's like, you guys don't get it. Like in, like we're so busy in Australia that we just eat to get full. We don't sit, we don't have the whole, let's sit down, let's listen to music. Like we'll do everything. We'll eat together. Like for us, that is like, if you do that here, you're telling your friends about it for a month. You're like, oh man, I had two friends over and we listened to music and we ate for 2 hours. Over there, it's just normal eating. It's wild. It's like, it's a really poor country, but money's not a thing. It's about like family and happiness and the way food makes everyone happy. I get this whole new lease on life every time I go back home. Like I get off the plane, I step in, I'm like, all right, cool, I'm home now. Like it's incredible.
The last year and a half has been challenging for many because of the pandemic. But what's it been like for you personally? Have there been personal challenges and changes for you?
Heaps. Jesus, where can I start? All right, so how long ago now? 4 months ago, four or five months ago, I got a puppy. I was like, all right, cool, man. Well, you're busy, you're doing work, but you kind of just go home and go to work. What do I want to do? I'm going to get a puppy. So I got a puppy and then, like a week in, he had to go to the vet. He had to have emergency stuff there. And then I took him home and then I was like, all right, cool. Well, I was like, I want to kind of get my own health on track. I went to the doctor to get a blood test and excuse my language, but one of my testicles was a lot bigger than the other one. I was like, oh, I might get this examined. I'll see what happens. That was on a Wednesday. I won't ever forget this. That was on a Wednesday at 10 a.m. I went and got an ultrasound. And then I was like, cool, I'm going to go to my friend's bar, Stuff Beaver and Bondi. I'm going to sit down, I'm going to work on some stuff. And I was sitting there doing my thing on the computer and then my GP called me, who's amazing. If you don't have a good GP, get one because they're the best people ever. And then he called me and he goes, hey, man, I don't know how to put this, but I need you to go tomorrow to get a CAT scan. I need you to get a blood test and I need you to come and talk to me in the morning because I'm about 95% sure it's cancer. And that's like, man, like growing up, that's the scariest word ever. Like, you don't want to say the C word. Like, it's one of these things, right? Like, you never think in your whole life that you have cancer. It's something that you never think about, right? And I was like, okay, cool. It took a while for me to digest. And I went home and I kind of did what every other human would do, which is do heaps of research, which is not what you're supposed to do. And just like got really deep into it. And I was like, all right, cool, cool, cool. So I woke up the next morning. I went and saw him. He calmed me down. I went and got a blood test. And then I went and saw my urologist. I had an appointment at 5 p.m. Luckily, my urologist is actually probably one of the best ones in Australia. So he got stuck in surgery for an extra 3 hours. So I was sitting there in a waiting room knowing that potentially that I'll have cancer for an extra 3 hours. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm just going to sit here. And I went in and he examined me. And he looked at me and he goes, okay, cool. Like, so casually, man. Like, I cannot stress this enough how casually he said that. He goes, all right, so it looks like it's a tumor. It looks like you have cancer. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, so I'm going to book you in for surgery tomorrow at 7:30. I was like, whoa, hold on, man. Like, you can't just tell me I've got cancer and then, like, cut me out tomorrow. I was like, can I have a few days to digest it and tell my family? And he's like, yeah, cool. That was on Thursday night. So I potentially had it on Wednesday. I knew I had it on Thursday. And then he booked me in for surgery Monday morning at 7:30. They sliced me open, took my one testicle. I've got one now, which is kind of funny. There's heaps of good jokes there. And then it was just like 2 weeks of recovery. And unfortunately, I'm one of those people that can't sit still. So I think I did about a week and a bit. And I was like, I've got to go back to work. I've got to get moving. So I went back and did a few shifts. But then during this period, right, because it was so quick and everything was happening so fast, for me, it was surgery just to get rid of my nut. Like, it wasn't anything serious. I was like, oh, whatever. It's just like, they'll just get rid of it and I'll be fine. It wasn't until 3 weeks after my surgery that I went into the Kinghorn Cancer Center, and I was sitting there and I was just like, there's cancer written everywhere, and there was like people that are older around me, and one of the ladies unfortunately had to get rushed to emergency because her stuff was gone. And I was like, oh, holy shit, I had cancer. Like, and it clicked then. It was like, okay, cool, so this is quite serious. And at that time, I still didn't know that I was in the clear. So I still had to go get more CAT scans and more, which I still have to continue getting blood tests and stuff for the next 5 years. But at that time, I wasn't sure that I was in the clear. So I sat down with the oncologist and he's like, look, luckily it's stage 1. It doesn't show that it escaped the testicle, any of the cancer cells, but we still need to wait for the test results. There's potential that you might get chemo. And funnily enough, the first thing that came to my head when they told me that I might have chemo is like, what happens if I lose my mustache, man? Like, am I going to have to get a fake mustache to wear in the hospital? You know what I mean? Like, that's who I am. I don't care about my hair, but I don't want to lose my stash. And then, yeah, so I had that. And then, like, I went home and I was like, cool. Well, lucky at that point, I was like, cool, it's stage 1. It's okay. None of the cancer cells had escaped. It's okay. But still, I didn't know that nothing spread. So not until 2 weeks after that, when I got blood tests and more CAT scans and I went back in, and my oncologist was like, hey, everything's perfect. There's no more tumor readings in your blood. The lymph stuff is in your stomach has decreased and looks like you're in the clear. Looks like everything's fine. And I was like, oh man, sweet. Like, I'm going to be okay. She's like, yeah, everything's fine. You're doing great. We still need to continue doing the checkups, but like, looks like you're going to be all right. So when you say how was a year and a half, it was a roller coaster, man. But it was a roller coaster of 5 weeks. Like, from the time I found out to the time I was clear, it was 5 weeks. So I didn't really have enough time to digest it. As I said, the first 3 weeks were cool. I'm just gonna get my nut cut off. Lance Armstrong's only got one nut. That's pretty cool. So I was like, but not until I went into the cancer center, I was like, holy shit, all right, cool, man. This is quite serious. This is really good. And I never wanted to I posted about it and I made sure in the post, I was like, look, man, this isn't a sympathy post. The reason why I'm doing this is because it's such a thing that humans do where we're like, oh, cool, that doesn't look right, but it'll be fine. I'll just leave it for a little bit longer. If I jumped on it a bit earlier, maybe it could have been less of a problem, but because being a human, you're like, nah, it's fine. It'll be all right. It'll go away. It never went away. It got bigger and it got worse to the extent where I ended up having cancer. So what I'm trying to say is, if you have any issues, anything, go get your shit checked out, man. Like, don't leave it aside. Go see a GP. Go get a blood test. All that stuff's free.
With the chance to reflect back on that experience now, has it had an impact on you and the way that you're living your life?
100%. More than ever. It was something that, you know how people are always like, oh, yeah, like, I do things. I'm never going to regret it. That's bullshit, man. Like, people are always like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go do this thing. I'm going to go do this. No one does it. Everyone just sits in bed, looks at their phone and Instagram for that extra hour and a half in the morning, and then they don't end up doing anything and they get lazy about it. Going through what I did and knowing that potentially it could be quite bad, now I look at things differently. I'm like, all right, cool. Well, I'm going to go do the washing. I'm not just going to leave it. I'll do the washing. I'm going to go to the gym. oh, I won't just not, I'll just do it. Like, I do things now. Like, cool, well, I want to start this thing. Like, do start working on Natty by Nature next year, like, to put on another festival. Instead of just writing the name down, I'll actually start working on it. I'll do things. It's like, it's this whole new thing. You're like, oh, man, I went through a fair bit. Well, how can I fix it? I'm just gonna actually do these things. Like, I think that's what it's done for me. It's made all of this. You may as well do these things properly.
For someone that grew up in pizzerias and now involved in the family business, what makes a great pizza?
The dough, man. It's the dough. You can put whatever toppings you want on it. It's the dough. My dad's had the same dough recipe for 35 years. It's only me, him, my brother, and my mum that kind of like know it, but he's always tweaking with it. He's always doing something. It's the dough. And people will tell you that as well. They'll come into the restaurant and be like, man, this dough's great. My dad, like, and I'm not being biased, my dad's got one of the best doughs around that I've ever had. A great pizza is in the dough. It's in the base. Like, you can't, like, what's that saying about building a house? You can't build a house without the framework or whatever it is. That's the way pizza is. You can't make a good pizza if the dough's shit. You can put the most expensive salami in and doya and prawns and whatever. If the dough's shit, it's going to taste like shit. It's basically it. It's always in the dough.
You've made a name for yourself in bars and gone back to the family pizzeria. What is it that you love about what you do in hospitality?
I make people happy. Food makes people happy and drinks make people happy, and giving a person an experience. That's the most important thing for me in hospitality. Giving each individual that comes and sits in front of me or comes and sits at our restaurant or comes and sits at any bar I work at is giving them an experience. That's the most rewarding thing. It's like when you see a person, they come in and they'll order this drink that they have no idea about. They may have read online. They may have done something and they order this drink and you're like, all right, cool. Well, let's just work through it. That might be a shit drink, but let's figure out what you want, and you do things together and you work through all this stuff and you give this person this experience. And you just, it's that smile. Like, you give it to them and they're like, oh, this is amazing. And you can tell, like, they might be talking there with their wife or with their partner or whoever they are. But they look at each other and it's just this like genuine smile and experience with like their friends or whoever they are. And that, for me, it's that smile and that genuine joy that makes me do what I do and will continue to forever do what I do. I don't care. For me, it's not about money. For me, it's not about anything. For me, it's just that. It's that genuine joy of people when you make their night or their day or their week.
Well, you've made a lot of people happy, Alan, and we're absolutely honoured to have you share a little bit of your story today on Deep in the Weeds. Please keep in touch and good luck, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much for chatting. I hope you have a great day.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.